Good afternoon. We have our third case for today, 11AP2902, Board of Regents UW System versus Jeffrey S. Decker. And the lineup for the argument that I have is that Attorney Harlow, Assistant Attorney General, has 25 minutes representing the Board of Regents. Attorney Gary Grass has 25 minutes representing Jeffrey Decker. Attorney Dustin Brown will have 5 minutes representing the Counsel for the Amicus Curiae. And Mr. Harlow has 5 minutes rebuttal. Agreed upon? All right. Attorney Harlow.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the Court, my name is Dwayne Harlow, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the petitioner, the Board of Regents, in this matter. This case is about the Board's ability to protect itself from Jeffrey Decker and his harassing conduct. It's about the Board's ability to protect itself from an individual who has been suspended and banned from Board property because he was found to have engaged in disorderly conduct related to a meeting with a campus chancellor where Decker stabbed a stack of papers, narrowly missing the chancellor's hand. It's about the Board's ability to protect itself from an individual who, in direct violation of that lawful suspension order, repeatedly and deliberately comes onto the Board's property. It's about the Board's ability to protect itself from an individual who, in direct violation of that suspension order, repeatedly and deliberately comes onto the Board's property and refuses to follow the lawful commands of police officers. It's about the ability of the Board to protect itself from an individual who repeatedly and deliberately violates that order, who repeatedly and deliberately fails to follow the lawful commands of police officers, and who repeatedly and deliberately requires police officers to remove them from meeting rooms and Board property. It's about the Board's ability to protect itself from such a person who, when a police officer comes to his home to serve him with the harassment injunction papers, refuses to respond to the police officer and instead goes to a gun store and attempts to purchase a handgun. This case is about the Board's ability to protect itself from Jeffrey Decker, who has established and made it perfectly clear that he does not respect the law. He does not care about legal prohibitions on his presence. He does not care about the lawful commands of police officers. He does not care about being arrested. He simply does not care. The Board is left to wonder, what else does Mr. Decker not care about? This causes the Board real and significant concerns. These are not concerns presented in a law school hypothetical, mind you. These are concerns that are presented to the Board in a real world, a world where campus violence is a reality, and a world where university officials must be diligent and proactive to guard against those who pose real and substantial risks to the universities and those who frequent their campuses. Under such circumstances, and in such a world, it is not enough that the Board has a right to seek arrest and prosecution after the conduct has been occurred or the harm has occurred. The Board, like anyone else, must be afforded the opportunity to act in an attempt to prevent the harm before it occurs. Our legislature has provided such a remedy under such circumstances, and that remedy can be found in WISSTAT 813-125. That section authorizes a court to issue an injunction ordering someone to cease harassing another if the court finds reasonable grounds to believe that the respondent has engaged in harassment with intent to harass or intimidate the petitioner. The definition of harassment includes engaging in a course of conduct or repeatedly committing acts which harass or intimidate another person and which serve no legitimate purpose, and it is that subsection that brings
us here.
Okay,
so we have to have conduct, right?
Correct.
We have to have intent.
That is correct.
Right? And we have to have purpose.
Your Honor, we have...
No legitimate purpose, right? Three things.
What's the third?
Purpose. No legitimate purpose, right?
I believe, Your Honor, that what we have to have, and I'll get to it in short order, but I can get to it now if you would like. But what we have to have is we have to have conduct. And if that conduct is engaged in with an intent to harass, by this court's definition in Balkowski, it does not serve a legitimate purpose. Having said that, if the conduct enjoys protection under the law and is constitutionally protected, then the serves no legitimate purpose would act to insulate that from the effect of the injunction.
All right. So, he objects to the university. The Board of Regents, is that the state?
The Board of Regents is a state agency, yes.
The state agency. And who's covered under this injunction?
Well, Your Honor, who's covered under the current injunction as authored by Judge Marks in the trial court here is the Board of Regents and any of its agents and employees.
Well, how many agents and employees does the Board of Regents have?
I couldn't tell you, Chief Justice Abrahamson, how many it has.
Well, there are 40,000 students. Are they employees and agents?
I don't believe that they are employees or agents of the board.
How many faculty do you have just in Madison? Do you know?
I don't know. I could.
Maybe 1,000?
Maybe.
And how many staff do you think you have in Madison?
I don't know, Chief Justice Abrahamson.
5,000?
Again,
let's just say there are 1,000. So does this cover 2,000 people at a minimum in Madison?
I think that if your assumptions are correct, that there's 1,000 faculty and that there are 1,000 staff, then it would cover those individuals. I think that,
How many campuses do you have?
Your Honor, I don't know when we get down to the UW-Fox Valley and the numbers, how many campuses there are, but there are many. And I understand, Chief Justice Abrahamson, what you are getting at is the breadth of the injunction as issued by Judge Markson.
Yeah. And Is it broad? I mean, just on the number of people it covers.
I certainly think that it creates issues with its breadth. I'm not so sure that the issue of the breadth of the injunction is properly before the court, and I say that because of this. Decker raised the issues in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals refused, or at least decided that it was not going to decide all of the issues, including the breadth. It stuck just with whether or not Decker's conduct met the legitimate purpose standard.
Yeah, but if you're going to succeed, you've got to succeed on all of these issues.
Well, Your Honor, I think that that is true, but I think that to the extent that the court has issues with the breadth of the injunction, I think that this court can remedy its own injunction based upon the evidence that was presented and provide for a more narrowly limited injunction, or this court can remand the matter. Pardon me?
Without a hearing and allowing testimony?
Well, I think that we've already had a hearing, Your Honor. I think that we've already had testimony that establishes what the harassing conduct is. I understand that.
What's the harassing conduct?
The harassing conduct, Your Honor, is repeatedly showing up onto the board property in violation of the terms of the suspension order. The harassing conduct is refusing to comply with the lawful commands of police officers. The harassing conduct is requiring police officers to carry you from a meeting room. The harassing conduct is attempting to hook your feet on chairs and disrupting the business of the board. The harassing conduct is going out into the hallway and tensing up when the police officers are attempting to handcuff you.
That's not enough.
Go ahead.
Could the injunction have been more narrowly tailored to accommodate Mr. Decker's First Amendment rights to freedom of speech, especially when we are talking about political speech, which goes to the core purpose of the First Amendment?
Justice Gableman, I think that it could, and I've discussed that with the board, and we understand the issues with the breadth of the injunction as issued by Judge Markson. Again, I'm not so sure that it's properly before the court at this time. In response to my petition for review, Mr. Decker's counsel asked for this court to address these other issues, including the breadth, and this court issued its order indicating that I was only to argue those things that were submitted in my petition.
Well, I think one of the difficulties of this case is untangling any elements of the conduct which could be described as harassing in nature from that kind of speech which could be described as political in nature. The latter, of course, being protected, the former, of course, not. And so it leads one to, I think, quite reasonably wonder whether an accommodation between the two could have been reached. And if so, what would the state's position be on such an accommodation?
Thank you, Justice Gableman. I think that at a minimum, let me back up. I understand that he has a right to engage in political speech, but it's not an absolute right, Justice Gableman. He does not have a right to come onto the board's property where he is lawfully prohibited from being and engaging in political speech. So at a minimum, I think that the injunction, if it be more narrowly tailored, would have to include a prohibition against Decker coming onto the property of the board. I understand that the reach of the injunction, not only as written, but then as verbalized by Judge Markson, could reasonably be read to impact more speech than is necessary to further the legitimate government interest in providing for the safety and privacy of those involved.
Well, under the terms of the injunction order as it's been issued, if Mr. Decker chose to mail documents expressing his view, and he wanted to mail those documents to the residents or employees of the various campuses or property of the board, as you refer to it, would that be prohibited?
Your Honor, I think that reasonably under subsection 3 of the injunction that it probably would be prohibited, and I think that that would probably be impermissible for the court to prohibit it. Again, I've discussed that with the board, and we are aware of the infirmities, if you will, with regard to the breadth of the injunction as drafted. But again, I don't think that that is the end of the inquiry. I think that this court, based upon the evidence that was presented, can tailor that injunction as it deems appropriate, or in the alternative, can remand it back to the trial court with instructions to more narrowly tailor the injunction so as to bring it into compliance so that we are not unnecessarily infringing on any constitutional rights. But let there be no mistake.
Harlow, Justice Prosser has a question for you.
Very good.
Certainly one of the issues in this case is whether this sort of a harassment injunction can be secured by an entity rather than an individual. Let me ask you to comment on the criticism on that issue, but even more to advise the court whether there are a lot of such injunction requests by entities. I mean, the Department of Justice represents all of the state agencies, and have there been a lot of requests for injunctions by entities?
Justice Prosser, my personal knowledge of injunctions that have been issued to public entities, number 3, including Mr. Decker's, that does not mean that that is the extent of the injunctions that have been sought by other public entities.
What are the 3?
There is one in Dane County that involved an individual who was an employee at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who had made physical threats against fellow employees and had made threats against the university itself. That matter was brought before the court, and it was an uncontested entry of the harassment restraining order.
But against whom?
James Rindall is...
No, I was. You said another employee. That's an individual.
There were a number of employees, Chief Justice.
A number of... Were they named individuals in that
lawsuit? They were not named individually.
Okay.
They may have been named in the pleadings, but the injunction itself was on behalf of the entity.
Well, let me ask this. Could you construe... Could this court construe the injunction as applying only to the individual members of the Board of Regents?
Justice Prosser, I think that given the comments that Judge Markson set forth, he clearly intended that the injunction reach more than just the board. And in addition, I think that it's important that it not only reach the board, but that it reach the board's property, because that is the source of the harassing conduct, is the coming onto this property unlawfully and engaging in this course of conduct that is in resulting in these disturbances on the campuses. But getting back to your original point, I don't think that there's any doubt that there is room for a public entity to seek an injunction. And the language of the statute makes it clear that the purpose behind the enactment is to enjoin harassing behavior. And the protection from this harassing behavior isn't limited by the language of the statute to natural persons or private individuals. The legislature's intention with regard to who can invoke the protection of the harassment injunction can easily be determined by simply looking at the language. In 813.125.4a, the legislature provides that the court may enter a harassment order ordering the respondent to cease or avoid the harassment of another person. And 990.0126 defines person to include all partnerships, associations, and bodies, politic or corporate. And there can be no disputing that the board falls within that definition.
Yeah, but you see, when I asked you who this injunction was directed to, you didn't answer the body politic of the board or even limit it to the members of the board. You said it went to the entire board, which is composed of how many people?
I'd have to look to Ms. Lattice.
All right. We'll just give a number, 25.
Certainly. It extends.
And it extends to all the employees and all the people involved in all the campuses across the entire state. So talking about a body politic, this goes way beyond the body politic of the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents is defined in the statute as a governing body with X number of members and who they are. But this injunction is bigger than that. And your brief made me think that you meant actually the body politic, the board. But it doesn't. It covers everybody.
And Chief Justice Abrahamson, again, I think that there are two issues. The number one is whether or not the entity can get the injunction. And the number two is if the entity can get the injunction, is this particular injunction overbroad? And again, I'm not saying to this court here today that this is not without its issues regarding the breadth. And again, I think that there are remedies to deal with that second part.
So what you're saying, if I understand, what you're saying is your response in regard to body politic was in response to Justice Prosser's question concerning whether the board is the proper entity to seek and obtain an injunction.
That's exactly correct, Justice.
Now, to be clear, though, when you talk about the prohibition and the only reason you're doing so is because that's what the injunction proscribes. We are talking about all of the UW campuses throughout the state?
That's correct, Justice Gableman, and I think that that part of the injunction is perfectly appropriate. Under Bukowski, the injunction has to be limited to the harassing conduct that was established at the hearing, and he has shown up at campuses on UW Fox Valley. He's shown up in Dane County. He's shown up across the state. And again, he is prohibited and banned from being on any of these campuses in the state, not simply the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
This isn't limited to university property, is it?
The injunction itself, as drafted, provides that he is not to come on to university property. But it also provides that he is not to have contact with the Board of Regents. And then, again, Judge Markson's comments, he included all agents of the board.
But let's just say hypothetically, Gary Anderson is a football coach. He's covered by this, isn't he?
He would be covered by this as
and
a
he'd
Judge
be
Markson.
Covered at Camp Randall?
Yes, at his
and
university.
He'd be covered at his home?
I believe so, under the terms as Judge Markson has laid them out.
Okay. I mean, how can you reasonably argue that this injunction gives any kind of reasonable notice to the respondent?
Well, again, I think that what Judge Markson was attempting to do was to provide full notice by establishing black lines for Mr. Decker to understand that no contact, not some contact, not this contact, not other contact, but no contact. And I think in his attempt for clarity, he's created a situation where we have something that is overbroad. And probably, again, as I've confessed to Chief Justice Abrahamson and Justice Gableman, probably needs to be more narrowly tailored by this court or remanded to the trial court. But again, that gets to the second part of the equation, which is whether or not the injunction itself is overbroad. We still have the first question of whether or not we could be entitled to one.
But let me ask this question. When Mr. Decker was suspended or whatever it is, and barred from all of the campuses, could the department have obtained an injunction irrespective of this statute barring him from coming on any of those places?
Well, there was already a ban and a prohibition in place, but Mr. Decker did not seem to care about that. I think that your question is, could we have went into a civil court and obtained some other sort of injunction? We certainly could have, and I think that the end result would have been exactly what we see with every other avenue that the board has tried. The board, Justice Prosser, has suspended him. He's ignored it. The board's own police force has arrested him. He's ignored it.
What I'm trying to get at, is there an alternative remedy to enforce the suspension that doesn't get us hung up in this particular statute and in this particular injunction?
I don't think there is one that provides the relief that this one provides. The harassment injunction is unique in that it provides very certain limits. It provides very certain penalties. It provides very certain remedies. And the process to go in and obtain a civil injunction, and then when the violation comes, get on before the court and then hold a hearing and then have the court make findings as to whether or not the injunction has been violated and then impose some sort of monetary penalty or something like that, I don't think is sufficient to achieve and protect the government's interests in providing for the safety and security of the board.
So I don't think that it is an adequate alternative remedy, and I don't think outside of the harassment injunction justice process that there is one.
But does this same statute apply to domestic relations cases?
It does. Well, it provides there is a domestic violence component to 813 that has provisions regarding domestic violence issues and restraining orders issued under them.
It seems to me dealing with the Board of Regents and an abused woman, it's hard to interpret a statute to cover all of those things without creating some mischief.
I respectfully disagree. I think that, again, the term person is broad enough to cover these entities, and I am failing to understand why, because we're not only dealing with domestic violence victims, Justice Prosser, we're dealing with neighbors who have disputes with other neighbors. We're dealing with a broad range of people. We're dealing with a broad range of conduct, and I think that that is the focus of the statute. And I notice that my red light is on, but the focus of the statute is on the conduct of the harasser.
But you have constitutionally protected speech where you're objecting to government action.
Pardon me, Justice Abraham.
You have constitutionally protected speech and conduct when you're protesting government action. So the question is, is this a place time?
Yes, it is.
The place is everywhere?
The place is everywhere that is owned by the university. Mr. Decker has no right to be there.
And individual employees' homes. You said that the was that a football coach?
I think that was Coach Anderson, Chief Justice Abrahamson.
Football coach.
And I don't know that he's aware of the injury.
His home and the 1,000 or 2,000 employees in the city of the university, their homes, right?
Correct.
In fact, if I were an employee of the university, if I were walking in the street, right?
That's correct.
Injunction covers everything. Everyone, everywhere, anytime.
Not everyone, but everyone who is an agent of the Board of Regents.
Right, which we agreed were a lot of people.
Right. And I do agree.
All right.
I think that the issue with that, though, again, is do we simply say, well, you've gotten too broad of an injunction, therefore you are entitled to none? Or do we take the course which Justice Gableman recognized, which is to say a harassment injunction is appropriate under the circumstances, but let's limit it so that it does provide adequate notice, so that it isn't touching on free speech, because he does not have the right.
Have you drafted such an injunction for
no.
us to approve?
No, I have not.
What are your proposal?
Pardon me?
What's your proposal?
My proposal is that any injunction enjoin Decker from coming onto the premises of the Board of Regents.
What does that mean? Does that mean Anderson's home?
No. Anderson's home, as far as I know, is not owned by the Board of Regents, although they have perks, so it could be, I suppose. But I'm talking about property that is owned by the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system. I'm talking about an injunction that provides teeth for the suspension order and the ban from campus, which he so frequently and deliberately violates. Thank you.
Did the courts create this form?
Records management.
The courts produce the form in the clerk of courts immediately after the hearing. You stand by, Justice Prosser, as they fill in the form, if you will.
This is a form that's put out. I think the question that Justice Prosser is asking, is this a form that is put out by our form committee?
It is.
And it is. It looks like a form committee.
It is.
It needs some work.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Gary Grass, representing Mr. Decker.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and everyone. Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Gary Grass, and I represent the respondent appellant, Mr. Jeffrey S. Decker, who is seated behind me in the blue and white striped shirt. The case today will decide whether the harassment injunction statute, 813.125, will be anchored to the original function that was described for it in Bukowski v. Salomon, or whether it will be extended to cover a new range of uses so that the state and its agencies can use it against civil disobedience, certain instances of public protest, and even simply showing up and appearing at a public meeting. Before I go on, I know that my client wishes me to point out again, because this is recorded and it's available to the public, the extent to which the facts in this case have sometimes been misconstrued by my opponent. Even just now listening to his section of the argument, he referred to Mr. Decker as someone who does not respect the law, who presents this risk to the university, and someone who is prohibited and banned from being on campus because he's a suspended student. As a matter of fact, that suspension was a one-year suspension, so that's expired now. There really is no way you could go forward and craft a new injunction that would prevent the conduct of him appearing on campus as a suspended student, because he's no longer a suspended student.
Is this moot?
I don't think the case as a whole is moot, because he if the injunction is upheld, then it will continue. It continues even though he's not there as a suspended student. If the injunction were reduced to the point where it said it could only prohibit him from appearing as a suspended student, then it would be a null injunction. I don't know if you're understanding what I'm saying, but it's certainly not moot overall. The injunction that they would restrict to only appearing as a suspended student, that would be moot.
It's moot because he's no longer suspended from the university?
He's no longer a suspended student. He was issued a one-year suspension that's expired.
Okay.
And I wanted to point out, because they said that he doesn't respect the law, he has appeared on campus, I will agree, numerous times. The cases that the instances that are before us that were established in the record, he was appearing at what he understood to be, and rightly so, public meetings of the university, which he believed that because he had a right to attend a public meeting, that trumped the suspension order's prohibition for him appearing on campus. So he was not deliberately resisting what he understood to be a lawful arrest. He was protesting what he understood to be an unlawful arrest. And he was acting, again, in his belief, in the highest respect for the law.
But as I understand it, Mr. Grass, your client did not simply attend those meetings as a silent spectator. He, at least according to the record, and I stand to be corrected if your understanding is different from mine, he did interject himself into the proceedings in a manner that was not consistent with the order that the meetings, with which the meetings were being run. Is that a?
I would say that is not correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I can be specific about that. The first meeting had a period in which people were milling about and talking, and he was participating in that milling about and talking. It was not a seated, very decorous type of situation in that first meeting. In the second two meetings, the Board of Regents meeting and the Fox Valley, UW Fox Valley Board of Trustees meeting, those were much more organized, with a panel in front and a gallery in back for spectators. He sat in the spectators gallery. He did distribute literature before the meeting. He only spoke aloud during either public comment period or during the period where he was being asked direct questions by the people that were sitting on that board, and so he responded to them. If you look at the record, the types of allegations that are being made by the regents as to how they were disrupted by his conduct at the board were things like, did he or did he not stand up to take a photograph, and when that happened, could people behind him see? No, he stood up for a second, took a photograph. People behind him couldn't see briefly. And that is not what we described as being contrary to the decorum of the proceeding. The gist of the claim of the regents appears to be that merely his presence coming onto campus when suspended was somehow harassing of the board, and that that invoked their need to protect people just because he was there. And I fail to understand, you know, even how we get to the point where it becomes harassment. I don't think that's the primary issue that we're here to talk about, but he does want it made noted on the record because of the stuff that's sort of floating around that isn't really what he did.
Does the University of Wisconsin have the right to bar a suspended student from any university land?
Yes, they have that right statutorily. I'm not exactly sure what higher purpose that law satisfies, but it is the law. They can keep him off of campus.
Okay, and did he violate that ban?
In his belief, he was not violating the ban when he came on to areas where public meetings were being held.
But there's no exception in the law for public meetings.
Well, you're right. There's no explicit exception in the law for public meetings. On the other hand, he can make an argument, and I can make an argument. I think I've made this argument that first of all, the ban is not absolute. The ban is not absolute. It's not a statutory ban that says if you're suspended, you may never show up on campus. There is an out mechanism that really leaves it up to the discretion of the chief administrative officer of the campus. And in his belief, that what happened was you have a public meeting. By having a public meeting, you invite the public, and that satisfies an invitation for him to appear. And in order to exclude him, there's case law that says you must need to have a real reason to exclude someone from one of these public meetings. It cannot be arbitrary. And the reason for excluding him was apparently simply that he was suspended, and therefore they were going to exclude him.
It seems to me that the rules that the university was seeking to enforce, in a sense, say you can't come on campus. And you're saying that those rules are virtually worthless any time there is a meeting that can be reasonably construed as a public meeting, that's an invitation for him to come. I mean, that's more than Swiss cheese. There's no rule at all.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree, because the university is open all day, all over the state, and has lots and lots of activities that are not public meetings where public bodies are meeting, where they're covered by Chapter 19. That would be a very limited exception to the universal ban to keeping him off of campus. And as he perceived it, you know, there was another incident where he, and this isn't the record, but he came on to a public way that bisected university land. And he's looking for ways that he can continue to do what he wants to do, which is have contact with the students, distribute his literature, monitor these officials, without violating the law. And in his belief, that did not violate the law. You may believe that he was wrong, but I only wanted to correct the record with regard to his subjective feeling of respect for the law. Mr. Decker believes wholly in the law and only will do things that someone else thinks violate the law if his understanding is that he has rights. He is not easily chilled from his constitutional rights.
Well, can he go to the union and go to the cafeteria and eat like everybody else in Madison can do? You don't have to be a union member, and you don't have to be a student or a faculty member.
And in that case, there's no interaction between Chapter 19 and Chapter 36. While he was suspended, he would be prohibited from doing that. He's no longer suspended, so he's no longer prohibited.
I have, if I can just deviate from a moment. 947.013 is a criminal statute, right?
Yes.
And it's the criminal statute that penalizes as a Class A misdemeanor, or can go up to a felony, right? And it penalizes someone who, with intent to harass or intimidate, hits or engages in a course of conduct with which harass or intimidate and would serve no legislative purpose. That's one of them.
Yes.
Has he ever been charged with this?
No, Your Honor. As far as I know, he's never been charged with that.
All right. So you don't have a good criminal statute with a civil forfeiture, misdemeanor, felony on harassing, right? With some of the same words as we then also find in 813.125. And this statute, which is what the one we're working under, hey, says you don't have to prove a crime here. All you have to do is commence an action. And this is a civil action, right?
Yes.
And what's the burden of proof?
That's a good question. I think it's something very, very low, like reason to believe. I think the only time an elevated burden of proof comes into play is when there's a firearm restriction sought, and that portion of it must be proven by clear and convincing evidence. Yeah.
And then you have a constitutional right on firearms in the state, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what you do is you just run right around the criminal statute, and you can just get an injunction. And you can get an injunction for any place in the state, right? And any person employed by the Board of Regents.
Well, they in their petition for the injunction, they identified the protected person as the UW system. It's the petitioner is different than the protected
person.
Well,
I was going to get to that. And the petition is different from what the injunction ultimately did. And the injunction only covers, as the protected person, the Board of Regents UW system. What does that mean to you?
To me, and this is based not only on that form, but also on the statement the judge made on the transcript that it covered representatives of the University of Wisconsin system, that it really covers not only faculty, staff, chancellors, regents, it covers students, because students have a governing role in the university under 36095. It covers any other independent contractors that might be hired by the university and employed on a temporary basis by the university. And as far as I can calculate, it's something around 5% of the total population of the state.
Everyone you think is covered by this injunction.
Yes. And obviously, Your Honor, the injunction is required by law to be specific. You can attack an injunction as being vague. It must give a clear instruction to the prohibited party of who they are to avoid and what they are to avoid. And, you know, Mr. Decker is, most of the public places that he would frequent in Oshkosh at any given time are likely to have people that he's not allowed to co-occupy a place with. So if you were to, very carefully and scrupulously follow this, he would hardly be able to get out of his house, I think.
And the court orders, if I'm reading from the right thing, this is order number 2. The defendant, that's your client, avoids the residence and any premises temporarily occupied by the petitioner protected person. What covers Gary Anderson's residence?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if he's standing on the street, is that a premise temporarily occupied by him? Is it Starbucks?
Yes, sir.
Could I ask, suppose the defendant were married to a university employee, and then there was a domestic relations dispute and an injunction, harassment injunction issued. Could he go on to the university grounds to public meetings in which the university employee participated?
an interesting hypothetical. Your hypothetical, the current injunction doesn't exist, but there's a separate injunction that just involves his relationship with someone who is a member of the public. Your Honor, I don't know whether that would be permissible or not. That's an issue I haven't researched. Obviously, when the injunction court is left with this decision of trying to sculpt this injunction, they would have to be very careful not to, in the process of granting what needs to be granted for that injunction, going beyond what is minimally necessary and thus infringing on his rights to participate in civic discourse by going to public meetings.
Well, your rights change, though. When an injunction issues against you, it means you can't do everything that you once could do, right?
Exactly.
And there's a hearing, and the judge hears testimony and makes a decision, and then we have a state form that the judge must fill out. There's criteria in the statute, and the point of the injunction is leave this person alone, wherever they are, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And so it is pretty broad in nature. It could be a future residence that wasn't even contemplated at the time of the injunction. But the point is, don't go where this person is. Leave them alone. Right?
Your Honor, yes. And again, depending on the circumstances, you know, you may be entitled to an injunction that says absolutely no appearances, you know, near this person at all or any place where they are.
Well, that's generally what they are, right? You cease or avoid harassment. That's pretty basic. Don't harass the person. You avoid the residence or premises temporarily occupied by the protected person, right? That's pretty basic. The next step is you can't contact them. You can't have somebody else contact them. You can't do anything to get a hold of this person. It can't be in writing. It can't be at their home. It can't be at their work. It can't be at their school. It can't be at public places. It can't be in person. It can't be by phone. It can't be in writing. It can't be electronic communication or any device or any other means. It's purposely broad. In other words, it's leave this person, leave these people alone. Stop contacting them. That, at least when I issued these, which was on a frequent basis, that was the point that I was really trying to drive home to the person. You know what? This conduct is unacceptable. This isn't the way we treat each other in a civilized society. You haven't been able to do that on your own, so an injunction is issuing. Let me be perfectly clear. Leave them alone. Don't have anybody touch them. Get around them. Talk to them. Don't mail them letters. If you happen to find out they're somewhere, you get out of there right away. Don't go where you think they might be. I tried to make that message clear. And the onus isn't on the alleged victim. The onus is on the person that the injunction issued against, and it is pretty broad.
Your Honor, I agree, but under Justice Prosser's specific hypothetical, if there's a special circumstance in which there is some necessity for a person to go the same place where the protected person would be, the judge has had liberty to craft that order in such a way.
Absolutely. You can change that. You can carve out exceptions. But you know what? If an injunction is issuing against you, it generally doesn't work in your favor and against the person for whom the injunction was issued. If you have to pick between who gets to go to that place, it's not going to be the person against whom the injunction was issued.
That's true, Your Honor. But again, I think if you have the special circumstance where you have a public official with this injunction, the court would be able to weigh that, and maybe there would be an exception carved out in order to preserve their right to participate in these sort of public events. And if that led to any additional trouble, obviously the court would then say, forget it, that's it, you know. You're going to absolutely no contact. Your policy as a judge is maybe different from another judge's policy. And I really am
I'm just following the law and the form, and those are the findings you make, and the message is you generally try to make it pretty clear. I mean, if you've risen to the level of getting an injunction and the judge is issuing it, the judge isn't saying, you know, some contact is okay. The judge is saying, no, this injunction means don't get a hold of this person. Don't come in contact with them directly or indirectly or in any way. That's what it's all about. So it is pretty broad.
Well, Your Honor, again, in the case of a domestic dispute, you're
are
generally
domestic
right.
Domestic abuse injunctions, there are harassment injunctions. Two different things have some similar characteristics, but they aren't quite the same. There are differences. So not every harassment is a domestic, and not every domestic is a harassment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's say you were an assistant attorney general representing a state agency, and you had a former employee who was threatening members of the agency because he didn't like working with them, he got terminated, or this or that or the other thing. What would you do to protect all of those people?
There are several things I could do, and one of them would be to, first of all, make those individuals who are directly harassed aware of their rights in the circumstances and encourage them to pursue their rights so that other people would be incidentally protected.
You would require each person in the agency to get their own injunction?
No, Your Honor. I would encourage them to do so because that would be one mechanism at my disposal. All it would take would be one, and you'd have if they were threatening people, they could be prosecuted for the threat. They could be jailed just for that. If the university is threatened, I don't know what the details of the threat statute are. But that might be an available thing to do criminally. The institution certainly has the right to go in under 81302 and seek just a regular, ordinary form injunction. We've had injunctions in this state for 140 years before the harassment injunction statute was enacted. So if there is a demonstrable need for that injunction, there are legal remedies that would be available. Your Honor, there's, one thing that was on the top of my list to discuss, and I haven't gotten to even to the top yet. Proposal that the state has that would read Bukowski as saying that the purpose prong is essentially satisfied whenever there is an intent to harass, I think is not a correct reading of Bukowski. It's wrong-headed, and it would dramatically enhance the scope of this statute. Legally, intent can be constructive or implied, so that any time someone goes and engages in conduct which they know is going to have the effect of harassing an individual, that intent element is satisfied. That happens in everyday life all the time. We do things that are disruptive of other people, and we do them for a variety of legitimate purposes. And I'm not just talking about a public body where you have protests or something. I mean, if you have to, dig up the street to put in a new drainage pipe, you're going to be disrupting the lives of people all around that. And you would have the intent to harass them because you'd have that constructive intent that you knew that this was going to cause them all this distress and dismay and it was going to interrupt their lives. But we don't cover all this broad range of activity because that has a legitimate purpose. If you go back to the history of the statute and why this legitimate purpose prong is there, it excludes an entire range of activity which otherwise would fall under the scope of the statute. It is an essential element. It cannot be simply collapsed into intent. The kind of fallback position that the state has raised, that if conduct is unlawful, then that per se would make the purpose of it illegitimate, I believe that's wrong as well. And you can take a more limited example where someone is engaging in conduct which is in some trivial aspect unlawful. I've attended protests at the Royce Federal Plaza on 3rd and Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and you have to keep walking on the street, and if you stop for a second, you're loitering, and if you go off the sidewalk, you're on private property, Every protest I've seen has had some small degree of incident unlawfulness, which is, just routine. Every protest has some small amount of that. It doesn't mean that the protesters' activity, their purpose of going there to protest and they're trying to change public policy, has become illegitimate. And if that were the case, you'd be opening up, again, the statute still to a broad range of activity which should be constitutionally protected. All right.
Is it legitimate for someone, either a man or a woman, who's been married, to object to some of the laws governing maintenance or child support or custody?
To object to them?
Yeah.
Simply to object to them. Of course, anyone has a right to object to them. I'm not sure if there's more to that.
Well, it's a lawful purpose to object to them. Is that right?
Yeah, you can object to them.
I mean, could you picket your ex-wife's house to object to the fact that the laws gave her custody of a child?
And Your Honor, I think the purpose there would be legitimate. I do think that the purpose would be legitimate. I don't know that person would have no recourse necessarily, but I don't think that the harassment injunction statute would be a means for them to protect themselves in that circumstance. If their behavior on the sidewalk was disorderly, or if they had physical conduct or made actual threats or anything like that, or for any other reason were unlawful, that would provide some sort of mechanism.
You've got the legitimate purpose, and you've said protesting domestic relations laws in one way or the other is a legitimate purpose. Aren't you trying to divorce that completely from harassing and intimidating conduct?
Purpose and conduct are separate.
Aren't you saying, in effect, then, if you have a legitimate purpose, you are entitled to harass or intimidate somebody?
Well, if you have a legitimate purpose, then your otherwise harassing behavior would not be covered by the statute. Now, I should point out that in the specific circumstance you raise, a judge looking at the facts and looking at that circumstance would be likely to say, I don't think that your proffered legitimate purpose is real. I think just as a matter of fact, if you had a legitimate purpose to protest this law, you would go protest somewhere else. I think the only reason you're doing it the way you're doing it is because you have another purpose there, and which is your real purpose, which is to simply harm and injure this person.
My response to your response is that it would be a lot better to attack the complaints that Mr. Decker says are unlawful by the university system to go to court. If you believe they're unlawful, why don't you go to court? If he believes they're unlawful, why don't you go to court to try to do something about that alleged unlawfulness?
Well, he doesn't appear on campus. I should say I'm unread, by the way.
You may respond.
He doesn't appear on campus to protest the laws that would keep him off campus. He's going on campus because it's part of his overall campaign that he has. It's part of his gathering the information, monitoring the regents, documenting their activities. He's taking pictures that he can use for his publications. He's recording what they do so that he can write stories about it. One of the things in the record is some of the literature he's distributing is literature that he produced himself. And he is, in fact, actually a professional journalist. And part of his activity is journalistic to come there and do that. It's not that he shows up on campus simply to protest the fact that they're telling him he can't be on campus. If that were so, he'd be on campus. You'd have this case based on all sorts of appearances on campus that have nothing to do with public meetings. These are meetings where he shows up specifically because he's got this this very legitimate purpose, in fact, more than legitimate, it's something that we really favor in our society, is to have people engage in government this way and engage in civic discourse, to show up, record, document, monitor the government, speak in public comment period. And when he speaks in public comment period, he's not speaking about his being banned from campus. He's speaking about his underlying issue, which is the use of student fees.
In the first paragraph of your brief,
yeah.
Jeff Decker is a citizen who undertook a campaign to hold the UW system and its representatives accountable for unlawful conduct, apparently taking millions of dollars of student money without lawful authority in violation of a particular... Why haven't you gone to court on that?
Actually, Your Honor, he actually did go to court on part of that, and it's not recorded on CCAP because he lives in Portage County, which is not fully covered by CCAP. But he actually did file a lawsuit against the university.
Did you represent him?
As a matter of fact, I think, I'm not sure, but I think one of the documents in the record might be the copy that actually talks about his lawsuit. And yes, I did help him with that.
Well, is it your position the Constitution requires him to go to court, or that the Constitution allows him to petition the government in other ways?
Of course, Your Honor, he doesn't have to go to court. His failure to go to court might be a piece of evidence that would say that his purpose wasn't sincere. He did go to court. His purpose was sincere, and he would be entitled to go and protest regardless of whether he went to court.
Is a legitimate purpose a matter of law or fact?
You know, I've been thinking about that, Your Honor. I've said essentially that it's a matter of law, and I think in almost all cases it would be per se legitimate or per se illegitimate. I'm wondering if there might be actually some case in the margin where it gets a little fuzzy. But I think that to date the courts have treated it as uniformly a matter of law.
This is political speech. In a domestic violence case, it's not usually political speech that we're talking about, and we're talking about generally conduct rather than speech, which raises the Baruchowski case. When you talk about picketing in front of a residence, there are usually zoning or other laws that deal with that. So you have a violation of a particular law that you're moving into, rather than dealing on a public sidewalk.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, one of the facets of you know, when they were discussing the predecessor to this law back in the ALI meetings, and then they created this, what ultimately became what we have now in Wisconsin, this course of conduct harassment. This was intended as a catch-all provision, as you know. To cover things that weren't covered by the types of specific things that had been drafted for the Model Penal Code. And when they created this thing, they were very wary about the way it could go haywire and cover a lot of things, and so they restricted it with this legitimate purpose element. And the question came up, well, what about this? Well, what about this? What about all these other circumstances that we would want to prohibit? And the answer in the committees that were going through that is like, well, we're afraid of going too far with the statute, so we just leave those to other statutes. There's other things that people can do. You know, it won't cover everything, but there's more than one law. This isn't intended to do everything.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And we have 5 minutes for Mr. Brown, Dustin Brown, representing the amicus.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Dustin Brown of Godfrey & Kahn. We are volunteer attorneys representing the ACLU of Wisconsin Foundation, which appears as an amicus. Thank you to the court and also to the respondent for giving us some time today. There are two fundamental flaws with this injunction, one statutory and the other constitutional. On the statutory side, the circuit court failed to consider Mr. Decker's purpose and whether it was legitimate. The constitutional flaw, as the Board of Regents has already acknowledged today, is that the injunction burdens far more speech than is necessary to achieve the government's interest. I'm going to start my limited time today by addressing the board's proposed remedy to narrow the injunction before circling back to the statutory issue. The board's proposal is to enjoin Mr. Decker from going onto the property of the Board of Regents. This remedy is still overbroad. The reason goes back to the observation that Chief Justice Abrahamson made a few minutes ago, and that is that harassment is already a crime, Wisconsin Statutes 947.013. Yet the Board of Regents made no attempt to have Mr. Decker criminally charged. If attending meetings is a violation of this statute, if this is a criminal violation, then he could be charged. Under the First Amendment, a content-neutral injunction can burden...
Let me just stop you right there. A person doesn't charge a crime. A DA's office charges a crime.
Correct.
And so in order to do that, you'd have to call the police. Police would take your report. That would cycle through the DA's office. Then the DA's office would put it in the chain of events that may or may not trigger charges. And then the DA's office would decide whether or not to issue charges. And then that would carry with it a whole different series of events. You're not saying that the harassment injunction statute is something that people shouldn't use and that they must go through a criminal prosecution in order to get relief from harassment, are you?
I'm saying that this is something that should not be the first, the option of first resort, basically.
You should try to charge someone with a crime as the option of first resort?
Exactly, because under the First Amendment...
get the immediate relief that some people... And, you know, this, with all due respect, this is Mr. Decker's case,
right.
But this isn't Mr. Decker's issue. This is a statewide issue,
correct.
How we're going to deal with harassment injunctions.
Correct.
So, I mean, this is for a whole host of people, not just the parties here. So you're saying that people should go through the attempt of maybe months later possibly having a DA decide to charge someone with harassment and receive no immediate relief through the legislative determination that a civil injunction can issue.
Actually, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
This issue goes back to the fact that the party that's seeking this injunction is the Board of Regents. And this is an entity that's already been able to respond to whatever public safety concerns they might have about Mr. Decker's appearance on campus. When Mr. Decker appears on campus, because he's there in violation of his exclusion, they're able to have the police come, and the police are able to arrest him if they conclude that he is, in fact, unlawfully on campus. That is not something that's available to that's something that's much more difficult for an individual to pursue. And this goes back to the fact that the First Amendment, when you have an injunction, a content-neutral injunction, it's allowed to burden no more speech than necessary to serve a significant government interest. And in this case, by immediately pursuing this injunction, this is burdening more speech than necessary to satisfy the government's interest. Because even if you're able to obtain the injunction, the immediate concern is that Mr. Decker is going to be coming back onto campus. And even with the injunction, you're going to have to call the police if he's in violation of the injunction. It actually doesn't...
Did I understand you to say, counsel, that the civil harassment is more burdensome to the respondent than a criminal charge?
Is
that what you said?
Is more burdensome than a criminal charge. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the Board of Regents had the option of attempting to have criminal charges brought in this
case.
So
from that, do I infer that is what you suggest the board should have done?
The board should have proceeded incrementally rather than immediately pursuing an injunction which infringes First Amendment.
So what's the answer to my question?
I'm sorry?
My question was, are you saying that the board should have pursued criminal charges before pursuing a civil harassment injunction? Is that what I understand you to say?
I concede your point, Your Honor.
What does that mean?
I can understand that there would be concern about pursuing criminal charges rather than...
So does that mean yes?
I'm sorry?
Is the answer to my question yes?
And the question again is...
That's all right.
I'm sorry.
Counselor, I have a different line of inquiry for you. This injunction restricts Mr. Decker's possession of firearms. Mm-hmm. And I understand from what we have before us that he owns a number of firearms. Mm-hmm. Does that concern you at all in your analysis of the breadth of the injunction?
The ACLU is not taking a position on the firearm issue.
Thank you.
The brief states, conduct that otherwise may be deemed harassing or intimidating is not subject to a harassment injunction if it serves a legitimate purpose. Do you stand by that?
Yes. The legitimate purpose prong is wholly separate from whether or not the conduct is considered to be harassing or intimidating.
So that
those are separate elements that have to be found.
So that whenever there is a legitimate purpose or an alleged legitimate purpose, you can harass and intimidate people. Is that right?
This goes down to the question of a factual finding as to whether or not there is, in fact, a legitimate purpose. The circuit court can find that what an alleged legitimate purpose, if a party claims that they have a legitimate purpose, that that's not, in fact, their purpose. If their purpose is, in fact, to harass or intimidate, then an injunction would be appropriate. I see that my red light is on. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Counsel? Mr. Harlow, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'm mystified because of this. It suggests that the board should not seek a harassment injunction. What the board should do is try to invoke all of these other remedies. And I hear counsel for the ACLU say, well, it shouldn't be an issue of first resort. Well, guess what? This was not an issue of first resort. The Board of Regents enlisted the assistance of its own police force to have him removed. The Board of Regents enlisted the assistance of municipal police forces to have him removed. The Board of Regents enlisted local district attorneys to prosecute crimes. Some of the crimes were, in fact, prosecuted. Disorderly conduct. He was charged with an ordinance. And my understanding is due to a no-contest plea, he was found guilty of that as well. The fact is these tools are not doing what we hope that the injunction would do. And not only that, if what we are saying is, don't pursue the injunction, pursue a criminal response or a criminal prosecution, is that what we are going to tell the domestic violence victim? Don't seek a harassment injunction. Go try to have the person prosecuted for battery. I don't
but
think
that,
that
was
is
supposed
what
to be what's
for.
Being done.
Pardon me?
I thought that's what it is supposed to be done, that you prosecute for battery and domestic violence.
Well, typically it would be the opposite. The person goes to the DA, the DA suggests a civil harassment, and then the criminal prosecution follows the harassment.
And this, in fact, is not in the record, Justice Gableman.
But don't tell us then, please.
Very good.
That's
thank
the
you.
Problem.
But the simple fact is that simply because something can be prosecuted as a crime doesn't mean that you should be precluded from getting a harassment injunction.
So what does the injunction give you?
The injunction gives Mr. Decker the express direction. There can be no more discussion from, well, he believed that he was entitled to come onto the property because he believed that it was a public meeting. It gives
well,
him
he violates the injunction, then what do you do?
Then it is something where he is arrested on the spot by the law enforcement officers, and it's more likely to be prosecuted, and or it is an additional charge that a prosecutor can charge him with, and one would hope that it would be a deterrent for Mr. Decker.
In addition to his violating, if he were still a student, that order.
Correct. And this idea that he's no longer suspended, that is true, he's no longer suspended, but the board has issued an order since, and again, Justice Rogan said this is not in the record either, but he does remain banned from campus under the Administrative Code 1811-7D and E, I believe that it is, and that is an order that bans Mr. Decker from being on campus. So he is still not legally permitted to be on campus. And I wanted to touch on something that Justice Prosser brought up here. The position that is being advocated for here by Mr. Decker and the ACLU creates an unworkable situation. It creates an exception that swallows the rule. Under their interpretation, the justice system's powerless to prescribe harassing conduct simply because the speaker says, well, I'm doing it to protest. Under the interpretation that is being advocated over here, Mr. Decker would be able to burst into the board member's home, yell obscenities at the board member and his family, all under the guise that he is protesting or unhappy with a board member.
Why don't you get him under trespass?
Again, we come back to the problem that Justice Gableman has at least identified, as well as what we've identified in our brief, is that we don't control the prosecution of that. We can suggest, we can have him arrested, which we have done. And again, some have been prosecuted, some have not.
So your
but
position
problem,
is that this injunction that you want narrow should cover the residents?
Pardon me?
So your position is that this narrow injunction that you want should cover the residents of all the employees of the state?
The injunction that we have sought, Justice Abrams-Hampson, or that I have suggested would be appropriate on remand, is simply to exclude him from university-owned property. My example was merely to expose the problem with the argument that's being argued by my opponents. But it's a license for him to engage in harassing conduct because he wants to protest. And he does not have a constitutional right to do that. Again, my red light is on. I thank you for the time.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all the counsel who have appeared in this a novel case that comes before this court under this injunction. And so concludes our argument. In 11AP 2902, Board of Regents, UW System versus Jeffrey S. Decker. The court is in recess until further oral argument, which I think is next week, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:20 p.m. We are in.